COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
And now it's time for the Sports Kings from Queens.
Hello! Today is Thursday, May the 4th. Happy Star Wars Day for you Star Wars nerds out there. We are two-thirds of the Sports Kings from Queens. I'm Kevin here with Darren. Gino is not feeling well. He tapped out for tonight, but hoping he'll be recovered by next week. Lots of talk about in the world of sports. Baseball is a month into the season, and neither local team is doing that well. The NFL draft was last weekend. We'll take a look back at that. The most exciting 2 minutes in sports is this weekend, the 149th running of the Kentucky Derby. But we'll start with the playoffs. The Rangers and Islanders are out in hockey. The Nets are out in basketball. For the first time in a decade, the Knicks have advanced to the second round, renewing an old rivalry with the Miami Heat. So let's start there. Darren, what do you think? Knicks Heat. For those of us of a certain age, we remember those great, great battles. Ewing Mourning, Jeff Van Gundy hanging on Mourning's legs.
Larry Johnson. Larry Johnson. Tim Hardaway, Allen Houston hitting the floater, Knicks getting ejected, bench clearing balls, PJ Brown picking up Charlie Ward and basically slamming him on his head. We've had a lot of good things in this series over the years. This is a different one. The game is a little bit different now.
Oh, it's much different now.
Physicality is not as encouraged. So let's do a quick analysis. The Heat beat the Knicks up pretty good in game one. The Knicks played without Randle. The Knicks struggled but got by the Heat in game two. Heat played without Butler. So each team has had that situation where they've had their arguably their best player. The only reason why I call Randle the best player is because he was an all-star. I still think Brunson's the best player on the team. But if you're going to say the two all-stars have each missed a game, now they're saying that Butler could play game three, which is a big difference maker. We'll see what happens there. Got to tell you, it's the Knicks should have won a little more comfortably without Jimmy Butler on the floor, I thought, and makes you nervous as a Knicks fan as they go forward, Kev. I don't know what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, without Butler, you're hoping for more than a six-point win. Game was way too close. We said, I think last week or in our previews on Facebook, make sure you're watching for us on Facebook. We've been making predictions on the series, on the game sevens. But we said Jimmy Butler is the best player on the series. Knicks probably have the better team. But at this point of the season, you know, a lot of times the best player wins. Jimmy Butler is the best player in the series. And without him, the Knicks needed to win comfortably. They didn't. They're going down to Miami now for the next two. As a Knicks fan, you're really worried about coming back for game five down 3-1, especially if Butler does play in game three.
Yeah, the Knicks need to earn a split here. And Brunson had a very nice game, too. He had 30 points. He played really well. Randle, again, early on looked good. Barrett shooting a little bit better than he has all season. But then you get nervous when he starts taking big shots down the stretch with that long range because it just doesn't look right. The Hartenstein, looked really, he actually looked pretty good. He played more than Robinson, I thought, in big spots in game two. The thing that the Knicks are going to need, though, is Hart's going to have to hit a few jumpers here and there, too. He grabbed every big rebound the Knicks needed down the stretch, which I was impressed with. Josh Hart plays great defense. He rebounds. He passes the ball, hits a couple of open shots. But they're going to need him to shoot a lot better than 4-for-11 for this team to go forward. I think if they need four guys to score 20 points in order to offset what the Jimmy Butler thing is, the Jimmy Butler factor, I should say.
And, unfortunately, yep.
And Vincent has been shooting really, really well, which is not a household name, so puts a little bit more pressure. But You know, if the Knicks come down back down 1-3, you know, coming home, it's not a it's hard to like them to get through. It's hard to like them to beat Butler in three straight games.
Yep. Well, that my prediction would look a little bit better. Heat in six.
I think the Knicks in seven. So I need them to come back 2-2 to make this exciting.
Trust me, I'm rooting for the Knicks here. No doubt about it. Heart said Knicks. I got burned in the first round, taking the Islanders with my heart.
I took the Islanders.
I wasn't making
too,
the same mistake again. Again, I just think with Butler playing this well, you know, Miami was able to take care of the Bucks in a big surprise in the first round. Surprising enough that, you know, the Bucks fired Budenholzer, the coach.
Yeah, he only won a title. You might as well fire him. He won a title 2 years ago.
Yeah. What have you done for me lately?
I mean, that was a little crazy. What'd you think of Giannis's statement about the criticism of if it was a failure of a season?
Well thought out. Heave the moment, you know, post game, I don't want him being that philosophical. I want him pissed off that he lost.
Me too.
The deep think, if he had a day or two to come out with those thoughts, if somebody had interviewed him the next day where he had a chance to sit back and really analyze, his comments were pretty point on, I think. I didn't have a problem with the tone of with the you know, meaning behind the comments, but like I said, immediately after the game, you want a little bit more fire, you want a little bit more, you know, I'm pissed that we lost, and it was a failure.
Yeah, listen, that's the fact. You're the one seed playing the eight seed. You were 1-1 and lost three straight, including the clincher on your home court. It was a failure of a season. I'm sorry. You can say what you want. You go in as the one seed, you failed. And you can say, it's everything's a building block, and I get that. But that's just that's just crap.
But that's something you make a couple days later, not the day of.
Exactly. And now you wonder, I mean, because this is the way the NBA is, your first thought is, was Giannis behind the coach getting fired? Budenholzer getting fired. I mean, was Giannis, because this is what the NBA has become. The best player goes into the owner and says, I want to play with this guy and I want this guy fired. It's happened a ton. It hasn't just happened once. It happens all the time now. This is, the players run the league, not the coaches, not even the ownership.
You know, you think back to the 80s with Magic Johnson getting, was it Westfall fired?
West Head.
That's right.
Well, West Head.
And it was such a rare occurrence back in the early 80s. I mean, I know we're going back 40 years, and I know I'm aging myself that I remember this stuff. But I like remember you said, nowadays, you know, it's common. I mean, you don't think the Nets Big Three had any say in who the Nets coach was?
They got Kenny Atkinson fired. I mean, there's no mystery there.
Who's a better coach?
What was that?
Who's a better coach, Atkinson or Nash?
Atkinson. It wasn't even that close. Kenny Atkinson coached that team when they didn't have the talent. Then they get the talent, and then they want their own guy. They want a guy that's never coached before. And this is what happens, you know. And you know, it happens all over the league. LeBron has got Tyronn Lue. He got Mike Brown. He's done it a couple of times, you know. And it's, you know, I'm sure there are some owners that stick to their guns. But you'll see if Phoenix loses this series, if Durant tries to do something against what they have going on now. I mean, you know, you just don't know in the NBA. Players have a ton of control.
They do.
Listen, I have nothing against free agency. I have nothing against players getting to play where they want to play. I mean, listen, it's a free enterprise. You know, it sucks if they leave your team to go to another team and build a dynasty. I don't like it, but I respect it. But the fact that they can say, I don't want to play for this guy, you could fire this guy, and they ruin people's livelihoods, blows my mind. Now, at the same time, we don't know that Giannis did anything to Budenholzer. We don't know. But it seems kind of odd, you know, that a coach that won a title 2 years ago and has had Milwaukee consistently is up there is out. I just think it's a little bit of a weird thing.
I miss the thought about beating somebody and not joining forces with them.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it took Jordan how many times to get by the Pistons?
a lot. And the Celtics too, by the way.
And the Celtics too. You think MJ had any thought of joining the Bad Boys?
Absolutely. Well, he kept Isaiah off the dream team, so I'd say no. And
he,
you know,
he hated them. He wasn't going to join them.
And Mahorn giving him clotheslines as he's going down the paint. You know, there was not even a thought to it. You know, you didn't want to play with your enemy. You wanted to try to build up and beat them. And the NBA has gotten where I want to play with my friends now. And I'm going to play with my friends or I'm not going to play at all. But, you know, that's the other argument that's come up a little bit is that, you know, the old Jordan versus, not Kobe, LeBron argument. Oh, they punish someone that loses in the finals as opposed to someone that loses in the first round. LeBron never had to go up against Bird and the Celtics. LeBron never had to go up against the Bad Boys. He went up against a weak East. He had to get through like a net team that had Jason Kidd and a couple of guys that couldn't even make it on other squads that were making it to the final, or Celtics teams that had employee number 8, Antoine Walker, as their best player. I mean, he didn't have to – who did he go through? He didn't have to beat anybody. They try to compare, Jordan lost in the first round. Really? So you're telling me losing to the Celtics in the first round should be a punishment when they're on top of their game with Bird and McHale and Parrish and everybody else they throw at you? And you can only imagine how long that dynasty would have went if Len Bias, didn't perish with the drug overdose, man. It's just ridiculous. That dynasty would have kept going. And Reggie Lewis dies. I mean, it's like they got snake bit for a few years. Thank God that the players passed, but we got to see other teams.
I mean, even when he come down to Paul Pierce, he was lucky to survive the stabbing.
Very true.
For a long time, that franchise seemed like it was cursed after all the run of championships they had.
No, it's nuts. Speaking of the Celtics, I mean, might as well get into that series. Celtics-Philly, 1-1. So Philly beats the Celtics without Embiid. Then they get Embiid back, and the Celtics blow them out in the biggest possible way.
When the Celtics can play Jason Tatum for 19 minutes, he scores 9 points, and they win by 30. That's a pretty good night. One of the things that was surprising, and I was talking to my son, since he's a big Celtics fan, his takeaway from game one is ticked off that they lost, of course, at home. But he said he was surprised at the level of play of both teams. Both teams played great, and Harden willed the Sixers to win game one. I thought, you know, I was concerned going in the rest versus Rust.
Mm-hmm.
Celtics, you know, yes, they were pushing 6 games with the Hawks, but they did have 3 games off or 3 days off between games. So they weren't, you know, playing the next night type. The Sixers had 8 or 9 days off, and you thought they might come out a little rusty, and especially without Embiid, you really were surprised at how well they played. Like I said, Harden carried them in game one, and the Celtics came out in game two and just said, yeah, we're going to win the series. Stop this. So it'll be interesting game three. Let's see if game two was enough for Embiid to sort of get back into the lineup, get back into the flow of the series. And let's see if he comes out stronger in game three.
Now, the one stat with Embiid that I saw, was he 1-9, I think, against the Celtics in the playoffs when he plays?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it's just a team that has his number. I don't know what the story is. But Embiid has struggled with the Celtics in the playoffs. It's just hard to imagine the Celtics not winning this series. I just think they're the better team.
Yeah. Well, they've done it. Especially earlier in his career, I think, you know, the crafty veteran Al Horford would do enough to throw Embiid off his game. I think Embiid's matured a lot since then. But now you've got guys like Williams who can match up with him physically, along with, you know, bringing guys like Horford. They've got a number of different guys and some different skill sets there to run at Embiid.
Finish your point. Sorry.
I was going to say, it's not just, hey, we're going to match up a 7-foot center against you and try to pound on you. We've got different looks that we can give you.
And Embiid's the MVP this year. He's a different Embiid.
He is.
He's gotten better. I mean, and he was really good the last couple of years. It's not like he wasn't, but this year he got to the mountaintop.
Yep.
So, you know, after claiming that it was race was the reason why he wasn't winning the MVP, he won the MVP this year.
Yep.
You go out west. Nuggets over the Suns in the first two. Paul hurt, little bit of a dagger to the Suns right now. What are your thoughts on this series?
Yeah, I thought the Suns would be a little bit more competitive, of course.
I picked them to win it.
We both had them in six.
Yeah. So now they have to sweep four. No problem.
No issue there. Nuggets, even though they were two relatively easy wins, you know, double digits in both games, all they did was hold serve at home, if you look at it that way. Phoenix now has the pressure to go home and win their two games and try to go back to Denver at 2-2. And they've got enough talent to do that, even if Paul's hobbled or not playing. But, of course, you know, getting Paul back would be big for them.
No, I agree. I think, like I always say, until you lose that home game, I don't really panic about you. If Phoenix falls behind 3-1 or 3-0, it becomes a series kind of ending.
Yep.
And then Warriors, they blow out the Kings in Game 7 to get through the only first-round series that went the distance. The Kings just –
that's it.
They fell apart in the fourth quarter.
That was a shame.
They had nothing. They brought nothing in. And then they came back and lost Game 1 at home to the Lakers. Listen, I hate the Lakers. I don't like the Warriors. It's not an easy series for me to root for. I guess I root for the Warriors just on the anti-LeBron sentiment. But the Lakers came back and they're showing after beating and dispatching Memphis in six, 1-0 on the road. And now it's two straight losses at home for Golden State, who has been great at home all year and awful on the road. They've won two in a row on the road, lost two in a row at home. So thoughts on that series?
Who cares? Neither one of us like either team. Neither one of us can stand LeBron. And I think that's more just LeBron in total. I think neither one of us can stand the Warriors on the court. I don't think we think much of Draymond Green. I'm not a big Steph Curry guy. I liked him coming out of Davidson, but I think he's gotten way too big-headed and a stupid mouth guard.
It's annoying.
So it gets annoying. And of course, you know, part of it's jealousy that they win all the time. At least in the last, you know, 7 or 8 years, it feels like they're always in the finals. They've won, you know, how many titles. So I think part of it's just fatigue of seeing them in there all the time.
No, I get it. And you know, listen, I don't hate Clay as much.
Oh, no. Clay's one of the guys I like on that team.
Clay Thompson. I don't hate the whole team. I don't hate Poole. Steph gets on my nerves and Draymond gets on my nerves. For the Lakers, it's just LeBron, and it's more that he thinks he's bigger than the game, which kind of bothers me, and he gets treated that way. It's because of the social media element. Jordan might have had the same treatment if social media was around the same way 30 years ago. We don't know. Here's the one thing I can tell you is I won't be staying up late to watch these games. I don't like either team. It doesn't make me stay up late. If there's a weekend game going on, I'll tune in.
If it gets game seven, we'll watch.
Yeah, even if it's an exciting game six, you know, I might tune in. But I didn't catch much of game one, and I don't expect to watch a ton of game two tonight. One thing I'll tell you, I have 2 points. One point, though, and that's every year. I mean, the NBA schedules these games like crap. Oh. I mean, the Knicks play Tuesday, now they play Saturday. What the hell is this? I mean, yeah. I know they want the season to go to end of June, but enough. This is a joke. Let the teams play. We baby these players all season long. They get all this rest. Nobody can play more than 70 games because they cry if they do. I mean, I'm not saying every player. There's a couple guys that actually pride themselves on trying to play 80 games. But these guys don't even try to play. A lot of them play 65, 68 games. Take a day off every other day. It's like, what the hell's going on? They save it up for the playoffs, and then what do? We give them 4 days off in between games.
Yeah.
It's a joke. Joke.
They complain during the regular season. They complain about too many games, so they eliminated the – remember, going back 10, 15, 20 years, they used to have that four-game and five-day type of stretch.
Yeah.
Especially on the road trip. And you got through it. And if that was still on the schedule, and especially if you've got more of a veteran guy, maybe you find a game in that 4 and 5 day stretch to give him a blow. But when they're playing 3 days a week, do you really need to load manage this much? And like you said, in the playoffs, way too much time between games.
At least they had the decency back in the day to say, oh, his hand is bothering him, or he's got a little bit of an elbow crimp. They don't didn't write rest.
Now they just come right out and say it.
It's just that it needs rest.
DNP, rest.
Josh Hart came out and said, he goes, we play like 2-3 times a week. If I can't be up for these games, there's something wrong. I mean, I'm not saying that every player feels the way Josh Hart does, but for the amount of money a lot of these guys are making, they should. Yep. You're playing a game. Go out there. I'm not saying, listen, jet lag, all that other stuff. I get it, but my God, enough of that. And then the other thing, Dylan Brooks, not welcome back in Memphis, according to reports. Everything I read, this, he will not be welcome back under any circumstances. So I guess Memphis has had enough of Dylan Brooks from what we've heard.
Yeah. You know, you poke LeBron enough, and eventually LeBron will get pissed off enough to.
But you remember Dylan Brooks' big thing in college, right? He was the guy at Oregon that took the half-court shot basically against Duke, and then Krzyzewski kind of said, you're better than that. You shouldn't take that shot.
Yep.
Late in the game. I mean, listen, and that one, it didn't bother me, by the way. I love watching Duke lose. But Krzyzewski to act like a baby, I thought was a bit much. But now LeBron has decided that he doesn't like Dylan Brooks. I'll be surprised if any team signs him. You know, LeBron might get him thrown out of the league. I mean, you never know. You just never know. But that's all I got on the NBA. You got anything else?
Nope, that's about it.
All right, then why don't you tell us how the Islanders – give us a postmortem on the New York Islanders, Kev, as we shift the hockey.
I'm going to say this. The Hurricanes were the better team. They proved that they were the better team. Carolina also got – it felt like every bounce went their way. Goals going on off players. Even the game winner there in overtime.
Freaky goal.
You know, it was – you know, sort of down near the goal line, shot into the crease off of Sorokin's pads into the net. And there was no emptier feeling as a fan than watching your team lose a deciding game in overtime. It's like, there's a goal, and your season's over, and that's it. It's a beauty of the NHL playoffs.
That your season can just end. It makes it amazing. That and the handshake.
Oh. They've killed each other for seven games. And then they line up and go through the handshake line. Even when you saw, you know, like the Devils Rangers after their game. Yeah.
Where Timo Meier goes with
Trouba.
Trouba.
Yeah.
They hugged each other.
They hugged each other after. And, you know, I mean.
And that was borderline a penalty. I think the only reason they didn't call it because the Rangers were behind in the third period of a game seven. Otherwise, that's cold.
And you know what's funny is that, you know, it happened to a Devils player. And going back to the Devils' heyday, and you had guys like Stevens and Danico who would deliver those shots regularly, and you didn't think twice about those checks. Open ice, you flatten the guy, it's part of hockey.
You do remember the Lindros hit. That was probably the worst one where Stevens basically knocked him out on his feet.
Yeah.
I mean, Timo Meier was there
after that.
Yeah. The one thing I'll say about the Islanders, though, as we get back to them real quick, was that they decided not to attack in the third period. They sat back, and they had a 1-0 lead, and you can't kill 20 minutes.
No.
You just can't against a team that skates faster than you. They're younger, and they're faster, and you're sitting there just playing back. Like, listen, you survived game five where they pressured you like crazy for 3 minutes. You got away with it. You thought you were going to get away with it for 20?
Well, that was 3 minutes of action, not 20.
Yeah, it was just they allowed that game to be tied by not doing anything to pressure going forward.
I mean, you mentioned, you know, Carolina Younger. I said they were the better team. They, you know, people got to remember they were the second best team in hockey during the regular season.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why. You can't sit back against them. You mentioned the age, and the Islanders with Sorokin with their typical defense, their age is not a problem. They've got too many older players up front.
Yep.
You look at their forwards. As much as we love the fourth line, the identity line, you know, for 10 years it feels like they've been called the best fourth line in hockey, and they have been. You can send them out at any point of the game, and you feel like they're going to change the tone, the You know, how many times did they start the period? Oh, we've played a flat first period. Here comes Clutterbuck, Zekas, and Martin to start the second period. Try to energize the crowd, energize the team.
And but, it always works.
And it always worked. Clutterbuck's 35. Zekas is 32. Martin's 33. How much longer do they have? But they're not the guys I'm concerned about with the age. You know, you've got Lee at 32. Bailey's 33. Parise's 38. Nelson's 31. Even Pajot's 30. I just give you 8 of the top 12 Islander forwards are 30 or more.
Yeah.
This is not that's a young team.
It's Barzal, Horvat. I mean, those are the guys you're relying on. And Pajot still has good speed for 30. I'll give Pajot a little bit of a nod. But the rest of the guys are old, and they look old.
Pajot has a role as, you know, that third line center, the penalty killer, getting some speed out there. But what's the difference, you know, Lee, Bailey, I think even Palmieri's probably over 30. I think I forgot him on the list.
He's not probably over 30. He's definitely over 30.
He's over 30. These guys are all average players at best.
Yeah.
And when you're over 30 and you're an average player at best, you can't have that many of them on the team. Because come playoff time, they just don't have the legs. And it showed up in Carolina.
A young, fast team like Carolina, who probably skates faster than they made the Devils look slow in game one. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's how quick they were. You know, and I think that'll be an interesting series all the way through. I think, you know, Devils lost a couple of games 5-1 in their first series, so I don't think it's over by any stretch. But it's a little crazy.
Yeah, going back to that series there, like you said, the Rangers won the first two games 5-1, and the Devils came back and won four of the last five.
They
did. Dominated them in game 7, 4-0.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about that, I mean, coming back from the 2-0 down, I just, the Devils really owned game 7, and they owned most of the last five games. I mean, the Rangers played a little fight in game 6. They showed a little heart to send it back to 7, but the Devils really came out and dominated game 7. Schmidt played great. You know, again, you know, they went back to Vericek in game 1 here against the Canes. But, not the start, but they pulled Schmidt midway through, and Vericek played well, and he was the guy to carry them most of the season. But Schmidt looks unflappable a little bit. I mean, none of the goals seem to really be his fault. It's like, you know, just the way it works. I mean, the Rangers, for their postmortem real quick, is just, you know, if I was Henrik Lundqvist, I'm giving the wrong goalie, Igor Shesterkin, I would have been livid. His team didn't help him at all. No. I mean, every goal he gave up, there was nothing any goalie in the world would have done. You would have to throw your stick at it and hope that you got lucky. I mean, there was nothing he could do on any of those goals. You know, the Rangers just were outskated. They looked like they weren't really – they looked like they didn't give a damn for a little bit. It was kind of strange.
Surprisingly, too.
Yeah, I mean, because the Devils just took it. After winning game 6, I figured game 7 was going to be highly competitive. For a period and a half, it was 0-0, but the Devils were still dominating the game. Then they finally put one by him, and they got a second one, and, you know, and went all downhill from there. And Schmidt finished with a 31-save shutout, but you never felt like he was in any danger of giving anything up. The Devils really controlled it. Now you get this series between the Devils and the Canes, Kev. What are your thoughts? I know game 1 went to the Canes.
Yeah, watching the Canes play the Islanders, and I thought the Canes actually had a little bit more trouble with the Islanders than they should have. I think the Rangers are a better team than the Islanders, and for the Devils to come back, especially after losing the first two and taking 4 out of 5, I thought the Devils were on a little bit more of a roll than the Canes, if that makes sense. And I thought the Devils are going to come out looking a lot better than they did in game 1. Not surprised that they lost, but surprised at how they lost. You know, if they lost 3-2 on a close game, you know, third period goal by Carolina, I would say, yeah, sure, no problem. You know, that's especially off of playing game 7 two nights earlier. You expect some letdown, but it was a little too much letdown for me.
Well, they had one shot on goal in the first period, so they really came to play. I mean, that's hard to do in an NHL game, to get one shot on goal. And that's what they did. I mean, they picked up the pace in the second and third. They actually put a lot of pressure on after they scored that first goal. looked like they might get a second. It obviously did not happen. A 3-2 game would have made it a completely different game, but they couldn't beat Anderson, who I was stunned that they went to the move to Anderson in game six. I thought Ronta had played pretty well, and it seems like it's worked out just fine.
It certainly has.
They won game six and they won game one. So right now they're 2-0 with the Great Dane in net, and that's the way it goes.
Yep.
Other series, though, as we look at it, we have the biggest – well, I just got to make an apology to Bobrovsky, okay, because I said he doesn't scare me. Now this guy in net has beaten a 62-win Lightning team in the playoffs and a 63-win Bruin team in the playoffs. So obviously Bobrovsky knows how to play goal and has been a giant killer. And Florida gets by the Bruins – down 3-1, come back and win games 5 and 7 in Boston, and advance to play the Leafs, who get the John Tavares goal to make you happy, Kev.
Oh yes.
And right now the Leafs are playing the Panthers, and it looks like the Panthers are going to go up 2-0. They have a one goal lead with under 2 minutes to play, so you know, anything could happen. But thoughts on the Panthers Bruins just real quick.
Obviously shocked. I know Bobrovsky played good games down the stretch, but let's face it. He also gave up 11 goals in the last three games. If you told me Boston was scoring 11 goals in the last three games, they would have had to win at least one of them. I was more shocked at 15 goals allowed by the Bruins in the last three games.
I was a little surprised by the move to Swayman. I really was. I understand that he had a good season, but he hadn't played all series. Now you bring him out in game seven. I thought that was a risky move.
Yeah, I would have done it. Yeah.
I think you had to stick with him. I thought the move to Swayman was not a smart move. I thought it was a panic move.
You had the best defense in the league. You had the best goaltending in the league. And like I said, to give up 15 goals in three games just blows my mind.
And it was nuts.
and we had the best team in history in the regular season go down in the first round.
We had said it when the playoffs started that the teams with the three best records of all time had never gotten to a final.
Yep.
And this time they got knocked out in the very first round. And right now, Florida looks like they're about to go up 2-0 on the road, which would be, what is that, four straight road wins. Yep. And five of the last six in the playoffs.
Five in a row. They won game two in Boston, too.
I thought they won game one. They won game two?
They won game two. I'm just looking at the results. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So
this would be five straight road games.
Five straight road wins, which, I mean, listen, I mean, as far as I can see, there's still a minute 28 left. I stream. Yep. You're a little bit ahead of me, so you might be a little ahead. But right now, Toronto, who got by Tampa Bay, and they got by them relatively easily, actually. I mean, the games were competitive, but it only took six games for them. And that's how the East was won. I know you don't want to talk much about Toronto, but the Leafs are trying to exercise some demons there.
It took six games, three of them in overtime wins. So it was a close series throughout. You know, a bounce of the puck either way, you never know. But credit to the Leafs, they pulled out the three overtime wins they needed and won the series in six.
Yeah, they got through Tampa, who's like a perennial world beater, it seems. So it's definitely different.
Well, Elder fans are very familiar with the Lightning.
Well, I mean, yeah, they've knocked you out several times.
Losing to them twice in a row in the conference finals.
when some of those Island players were still in their 20s.
Yes.
Totally different time back then.
Yep. Just overall, the first round, you know, we talked about the NBA first round where there was one game seven. In the NHL, there were three game sevens, and four of the series went to game six. So it's been an evenly matched NHL playoff so far.
It's been real good. Most of the higher seeds have won. I mean, there weren't
except for the defending champion Avalanche.
Yeah, well, the Avalanche and the Bruins were the big losers.
Yeah.
I mean, the Leafs were technically the highest seed over Tampa, even though it seemed like an upset. And,
those were the only two upsets.
Yeah, I mean, that was it. I mean, speaking of the other upset, let's go to the Kraken.
Yeah, do we have to?
I mean, listen, no one expected it. I didn't expect it at all. I don't think the Lanch have the money goalie, to be honestly. I think they have to look to improve him between the pipes because there's so much talent out there. But very, very surprised that they lost that series, game 7 at home.
2-2 going back to Colorado. They lose game 5 at home.
And they win game 6 on the road.
Come back and win game 6 on the road, and you figure, all right. But the interesting stat, if I remember reading it right, the Kraken scored the first goal in every game.
Yeah.
Hard to play from behind every game. Now, they did enough to come back 3 times and win, but you know, you can't do that every game.
Nah. And you know what? The Kraken are an interesting story. They go up against the Stars. Stars Wild. Only thing to talk about in this series, the Stars kind of, they lost game 1 and then they kind of took control. What's his name? Eric Sinel tried to play with a broken leg.
Yeah.
He broke his leg. He went back out for another shift. Couldn't do it. You got to give him credit for giving it a shot. Right? Only in hockey and
hockey.
Jack Youngblood getting shot up in the 70s when he was with the Rams. You see guys go out there with broken legs and try to play. But that series wasn't much of a series. Ottinger kind of controlled everything in net. Minnesota really, really couldn't figure him out. You know, Dallas moves on. Pavelski comes in, he scores all 4 goals. He got hurt in game 1, came back in game 5, scored all 4 goals to win it.
Yep. Out west, the story seems to be, don't let your teammate score 4 goals. Pavlik scored 4 goals for Dallas and lost, and Draisaitl scored 4 goals for Edmonton, and they lost to Vegas.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, last night Vegas wins game 1. It basically, to beat Edmonton, you have to stay out of the penalty box because you can't stop their penalty. Yes. Power play.
That power play is just incredible.
I mean, well, Connor McDavid can't be stopped. I mean, he's just the best player in the world. There's no other real way to put it. And it's like he's a magician with the puck on his stick. It's amazing. I hate Edmonton. I'm rooting very hard for Vegas. Edmonton can't lose enough for me. So I'm happy they lost game 1. And I think the reason why they'll lose is because I don't think Skinner's a money goalie. And I never have.
Yep.
And I never will. Until Edmonton figures out what they have going on in the pipes, between the pipes, they're not going to be dangerous, in my opinion. Now, listen, they can easily win the series on offense. They can win 8-5 every night.
Yeah. I think Edmonton – I take it the other way. I take it that point, Darren. I think that Edmonton's going to do enough to outscore Vegas in the series and win in 7. But, you know, certainly I could see Vegas. I mean, obviously, goes to game 7. You never know what's going to happen.
I mean, Vegas is the number 1 seed out there. But at the same time, it was so close all season between Edmonton and Vegas.
Oh, wow.
Colorado. All these teams had a similar amount of points. Los Angeles was in the hunt for that division as well for a while. Anything can really happen out there, but right now it's early in the series, so we'll see what goes on, as is all the series, as Florida has beaten Toronto, so they're up 2-0. Any other NHL points before we move on?
Nope, I think that's it for the NHL.
All right. How about those Mets, Kev?
Whew. You know, 2 weeks ago, they were in the middle of the San Fran series out west, and they were looking good. They were in the middle of a very successful West Coast trip. They even won the game that Scherzer got suspended for the sticky fingers. Since then, they've got 2-9. The offense has disappeared. Let me just read you off a couple of numbers here. In the last 11 games, Nimmo, 8-44. 2 walks, 15 strikeouts. Seen his batting average drop from 375 to 302.
One thing before you go on. So you're down 2-0.
Oh, you can't be stealing there.
You can't steal. And he doesn't even apologize after the game. He says, well, the statistics, he's 1.55 going to the plate, so I should make it 10 out of 10 times. No, you didn't.
Don't even try it.
Therefore, it's not 10 out of 10, genius. You can't get thrown out. You can't take the tying run off the out of the batter's box right there.
No.
Sorry, just a bonehead play. That's by okay. Oh my God! I'm like, what are you doing? Listen, I'm a Yankee fan. I'm rooting for the Mets. I like the Mets. Anyway, go ahead, Kev.
Marte, 9-38, 2 walks, 10 strikeouts. Lindor, 7-for-40, 2 walks, 11 strikeouts. Pete, 6-for-41, 1 walk, 14 strikeouts. That comes out to a combined 184 average for the top four over the last 11 games. They've got 2-9. 50 strikeouts, 7 walks. That equates to a 218 on base. You want to know why the best are 2-9? There you go. Starters, they've had this, you know.
Injuries.
Last two games, they got Scherzer back. They got Verlander back the last two games. The night before that, Peterson started twice. McGill twice. Lucchese twice. Budo. Senga got one start in there. And then, of course, they tried the bullpen game with Reyes. You know, a lot of it's been they've been pitching their 6th, 7th, 8th best starters. Now, going back to the top two who came back, Scherzer did not pitch well yesterday. I'm not trying to make excuses for him. He pitched. He threw the 5 shutout innings on April 10th against San Diego. Struggled through the 5, but gave him 5 shutout. They push him back a couple of days. He got suspended after the 3rd. He pitched 3 innings, got thrown out, got suspended. So this guy that threw 3 innings in about 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. You expect a little bit. You know, I know Met fans, you read on social media, they're ready to jump off the bridge. Oh, Scherzer's done. He's this, he's that. No. Scherzer got a chance to get out there, get back on the mound, throw. Let's see what he does next time. If he's not looking sharper next time, then maybe you start to worry about things. But the guy's made 5 starts this year so far. So let's cool it on Scherzer's done talk, all right? Verlander, maybe a little juiced up. You know, first start with the Mets today. Gave up the back-to-back home runs in the first inning. He settled down. He went 5. They're still building up his pitch count. He looked sharp after the first inning. You feel like Verlander's going to be fine. Getting those two back. Senga, they gave him some extra time. Let's see what he can do. He opens the series tomorrow. Senga needs to show a little bit better command of his pitches. He's been pitching okay. The results have been okay, but he's throwing 90 to 100 pitches to get through 4 1/3, to get through 5. He needs to get to the point where he's throwing 100 pitches to get through 6 or 6 plus, because his bullpen is going to wear out. Yeah, Darren.
The Mets in 31 games this year, it's 31 or 32, I'm trying to remember now. They have 5 pitchers that have gone 6 innings.
Yeah.
5 starts, but 6 innings.
Only one's gone into the 7th.
Yeah, I'm just saying, but they can't even give you 6.
I know.
I mean, you know, I mean, it's just, it. They're not getting length. And listen, you don't expect length with pitchers that are older, but these are two horses that you expect to be able to get as the season goes on, and hopefully you see it. But
yeah,
they didn't lose because of pitching. They've lost because of offense in a lot of these cases. They lost the showdown with the Braves. They got swept by the Tigers. Just 1-5 in the last 6 is just not good. And then lost to the Nationals before that. And they had to escape there. They almost got swept by the Nationals. If they don't get that late home run, the late heroics.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, the one guy that is hitting is Beatty. Time to put him up in the 5 spot.
No doubt.
Enough to hit him at the bottom of the order now. He's the guy that's hitting. You know, let him hit.
He's come up. He's hitting over 300 now. You can see him. He's hitting lefties. And I know Met fans, you know, again, oh, why was Escobar playing today? Why? Because Escobar hasn't played in 10 days. He's had one at bat in 10 days. You got to get him in there. And this was a chance, you know, soft toss and lefty. You know what? Give Beatty a blow here. Especially, you know, he's a young kid. He's 23, 24 years old. He can play doubleheaders. Mets had 2 doubleheaders in 3 days. He played all 4 games there. Not the worst time to try to get Escobar some at-bats. And Escobar's won at-bat over the last 10 games. Was a pinch-hit home run. you know, you've got to use all 26 players on the roster. I mean, so don't get me wrong there. Alvarez, after the 1-for-15 start, at least he's gotten his average back over 200. Not hitting the ball consistently like Beatty. I'm fine with him still batting down 8 or 9 now.
Just play him 5 days a week, though. I mean, come on.
Yeah. You can't have Needle in there with his 125 average.
He's an automatic out. And no one calls a game.
Watching the games, you know, Alvarez is not that bad behind the plate.
No, he's not.
He's better than I thought. That, you know, coming up, you were worried about what he's got to do back there.
The Yankees were fine behind Posada the plate for years. Who was not? He was not Girardi. They replaced Girardi with Posada. And yeah, nothing against Joe, but Jorge was gave you the bat, and you know, you let him catch.
Alvarez is showing that he's at worst a decent catcher right now, which is all you want.
Absolutely.
And you know, at 21 years old, you hope he improves from decent over his career. But right now, you need to get that bat going. But like I said, I'd move Beatty up 5 or 6. You know, where I think it depends. Where do you want McNeil batting? Do you shuffle it up? I mean, we saw last year when Marte was healthy, when this lineup was clicking, and you had Nimmo, Marte, 1-2, then Lindor and Pete. Who do you want protecting them? I think, yeah, you're probably right. I think Beatty has a little bit more pop in his bat. I'd almost rather see McNeil hitting 3, have Lindor maybe protecting Pete in the 5-hole, and then Beatty 6.
Yeah, I think you have to drop Marte as well a little bit right now. He's not even having good at bats.
Yeah.
I mean,
Marte, you think he's going to break out of it. I mean,
yeah, but I don't have a problem batting him. I don't have a problem batting him 6 right now.
Yeah.
I really don't. Let's get him moving. I don't mind McNeil batting 2. You put Lindor 3 and you know, Alonso 4. You go with Beatty 5 and you have Marte protecting Beatty. I don't mind that. Or you can do Beatty.
That's good.
Or go the other way and then you go Marte 5 and Beatty 6. I'm good either way. I just think that you have to drop him. You got to get more bats for McNeil. He's a guy that can put the bat on the ball.
Yeah. How much more time do we see Canna and Pham? Yes, it's AAA, but my goodness, Vientos is raking down there in AAA right now.
I mean, that's why you have a minor league system, so guys can earn their way up. Yeah. The reticence to bring people up blows my mind in this sport. It really does. The best player should play.
What did the Braves do last year? What turned them around? Who did they bring up? Michael Harris.
And Michael Harris, the center fielder, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, he's 20 years old. He has barely played.
Who cares? Who cares?
They brought him up. He won Rookie of the Year.
Yeah.
And turnaround.
It was huge for them. And it wasn't even the position that you thought they had of major need at the time, but they brought him up anyway, and he played great.
Yep.
Anyway.
How about those last place Yankees, even though they have a better record than the Mets?
You know, the funny thing
about that whole division's over 500.
Listen, when the Yankees lineup doesn't have Judge and Stanton in it, it looks really awful. And to be honest with you, there's only one person to blame. That's Cashman. He's built up a lot of equity with the stuff in the late 90s, early 2000s. But 2009 is a long time ago. And you know, this team coming out, and I'm not like Gino. I don't have the real hard on against Hicks and Calhoun like he does. And actually, if you didn't have Calhoun, you would have probably lost the series to Cleveland. So the Yankees are coming off a series win miraculously, but the offense is brutal right now. There's really nothing to like. Every time we throw Clark Schmidt out there, I want to throw up. There's so many things not to like about this team right now. Volpe's fun to watch. They bat him first. They're putting him up there. LeMahieu's hitting a little bit. I mean, but they have it's an entire team of guys that just struggle to put the bat on the ball. Rizzo's like the only guy that you feel any confidence with when he's coming to the plate right now. I mean, Bader just came back, and then he got hurt in a collision in the ninth inning the other night.
Yeah.
Hopefully he stays. You know, they say day-to-day. We'll see what happens with that. But they were playing without their starting outfield, without their starting third baseman. It's a lot. Trevino's starting to hit a little bit. You know, the thing about this Yankee team is that when they don't have Judge and Stanton, that order looks one of the bottom offensive teams in baseball. It doesn't look like the New York Yankees. It doesn't look like the Bronx Bombers. And yep. I've been saying it since the before the season. Clay Holmes, enough. He's just not very good. I didn't think he was very good. Last year, I know he had a good start, but I never had any confidence in him being good.
And that Cleveland game, I know he's given the explanation about why he went to Holmes there. You know, Marinaccio had pitched the day before. He got me 5 outs. I was really hoping for like 4. I didn't want to push him anymore. We want to bring the Holmes, get through that, and then set up for the next. It's like, what the hell are you talking about?
It's ridiculous.
And he threw him back to back, but he was looking so – Marinaccio was looking so good. Let him finish off the inning.
Of course. There's no reason to do it. And then
that's overthinking things.
And the first game of the series, Herman throws the gem. You bring in Holmes, he blows it then too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they got away with the second one. They didn't get away with the first one. They could have swept Cleveland. But, here's the thing. Either Herman's going to pitch tonight or he's not. None of these guys do a great job coming in with a runner on, especially not your closer. Most closers don't. They like to pitch with the clean sheet. I don't like Holmes. If you want to tell me he's my eighth inning guy or seventh inning guy, I can live with it. But that's about it. Enough of the garbage with Clay Holmes. I can't watch him anymore. I mean, Clark Schmidt and Clay Holmes.
Second half of last year, he proved he's not the clutch closer that you need. He pitched fine as a setup guy last year. Excellent as a setup guy. Not just fine. Excellent as a setup guy. But he's not a closer.
I mean, the thing about it is, you remember, you know, Cashman used to put a premium on relievers. You were sitting there with guys like Britton. You were sitting there with guys like, in front of Chapman. I'm blanking on the lefty they got from the, what was it, the Cubs? Why am I blanking on? He's gotten older now, but they had so many guys that could come in and pitch in big spots. And right now, you're living with Marinaccio is the only guy you could even count on in that pen. You know, everybody's hurt. Everybody, you know, all the big arms are kind of banged up. And they put no premium on protecting this bullpen. Again, Brian Cashman. At some point, Brian Cashman has to take some blame somewhere. For some reason, he skates through because people think he's a nice guy. I don't care that you're a nice guy. Win some games. Freaking ridiculous. I don't know. The best of the American League did best. The best of the National League this week as the Rays beat up the Pirates. The fact that the Pirates were the best of the National League at the time started the series.
That's incredible.
They're not the best, obviously, the Braves are. But Pirates had the record going into that series.
Yeah.
Padres and Giants played the first series ever in Mexico. It was the first game had like 11 homers or something like that, something ridiculous.
Yeah. A little high scoring affair in the high altitudes of Mexico.
It was like 16-11, I think it ended up.
Yeah.
And I don't know, the White Sox and the Cardinals are just playing awful as two teams that were predicted to be pretty good in their divisions.
Some of us thought the Cardinals were going to be bad.
You did. Well, I didn't pick the White Sox either, so I did pick the Twins. Not that they're doing anything, and the Oakland A's might be the worst team I've seen since that Oriole team that started off
0-21.
Yep. You know, this
Kansas City's not too far behind them.
Yeah, at least Kansas City puts up runs and they play a little bit, but Oakland's just horrendous.
Yep.
No God. Anything else on baseball you want to touch on?
And Jacob deGrom, elbow inflammation out. Bochy said maybe 2 more weeks before he's ready to maybe come back. That's why you didn't give him 5 years.
No, I get it. But, you know, you got to see if Verlander lasts the season and see if it makes sense.
Again, I think I said it during the offseason. If they offered deGrom a Verlander/Scherzer-type contract 2 or 3 years at big money, at that 43 million, that would have been fine for me. I did not want to see him go 5 years for DeGrom, knowing that he's every little pain, every little ache, he's pulling himself out.
No, he does. He always does. That's just the way it works with certain players pitch through the pain, and Jacob is not one of them.
Yep.
Never has been. So let's talk NFL draft, Kev.
Yes.
Give me your assessment of the draft.
Some shocks at the top. Obviously, we all have Bryce Young going 1 to the Panthers. The Texans did go C.J. Stroud at 2. And both of us have talked on the podcast here. We both like C.J. Stroud. I know I personally like him better than Bryce Young just because of the size factor.
I feel the same way. And that's because, and even with the Ohio State quarterbacks not doing anything in this league.
Yeah. Then the Texans shook up the draft, trading back up to draft Will Anderson, the consensus best defensive player in the draft. Traded up with the Cardinals. You know, there's a question if the Cardinals are going to drop back, but I think everybody was thinking, if the Cardinals drop back, it's because somebody wants to move up to get a quarterback.
Not the case.
Texans going up to get Will Anderson. The Colts stayed at 4 and drafting Anthony Richardson. Nothing like getting that one-year starter who completed 53% of his passes.
Everybody thinks they're going to find Josh Allen, guy that can't complete passes, but he's athletic. It's not easy.
Yep. Seahawks went Devon Witherspoon, the cornerback. That was a little bit of a surprise there at that high at 5. There are probably a couple of players there that we thought may have gone there. The Cardinals, after trading down, moved back up to 6 to take Paris Johnson Jr., the tackle.
They started the offensive line and run that hurt the Jets.
Yep. Raiders take Wilson. Falcons taking Bijan Robinson there at 8. Yeah, I was trying to read my writing. I was trying to remember what the first name was. First time running backs were taken in the top 10 since Saquon.
Yep.
Eagles, who had a great first round, they take Jalen Carter on the field. Can't debate what he does on the field. Got some of the off-field issues, was involved in that whole accident down there. Where there are 2 fatalities. I think the Eagles are a perfect spot for him. They've got how many Georgia Bulldogs in that team?
Yeah, there's 6, I think.
And they went back to the well in the end of the round in 30th and took Nolan Smith. That's great value at number 30.
It certainly is.
Now, here's where it hurt the Jets. 10, Bears took, I thought surprisingly, Darnell Wright goes 10 to the Bears.
Yeah, I had him as my 5th best offensive tackle. He went 2nd.
Yep. Titans took Skowronski 11th. And then at 14, the Patriots were sitting there at 14 and decided to make a deal with the Steelers. Who never trade up. And Bill sticks it to the Jets one more time. Steelers trade up to 14 to take Broderick Jones, the last of the top tackle prospects. And the Jets are sitting there at 15 going, oh, damn, there go the tackles.
It's over.
And I would imagine, and I think, Darren, you would agree with me too, I'm sure Douglas was working the phones. I'm sure he was trying to trade down. But I don't think there's anybody worth necessarily trading up to, anybody below. That you want to give up much and move up to 15. I think the Jets were stuck at 15, so I think they went with their draft board and took Will McDonald. Now hearing Kiper and McShay talk about him, you know, at least it makes you feel a little bit better about drafting him. The most bendable defensive end in the draft, you know, this and that. Definitely didn't think they'd be going defensive end there in the first round, but that's what they went with. 2023 started the run on wide receivers, 4 in a row. And the Giants picking up a very good pick there, 24, was getting Deontay Banks, the cornerback.
I thought he was better than who the Commanders took at Mississippi State. I thought he was the better player. I was a little surprised that Banks was still sitting there. He's a good cover corner.
Surprisingly, one name that I did not mention that entire first round, Will Levis.
Sitting there. Just sitting there. What a pretty hot girlfriend when he was sitting there.
She was a lovely young lady there.
She was much more annoyed than he was.
He's just thinking, you know, he's getting the same reaction to his birthday party, apparently.
Oh, my God. Just crazy.
So those were my first round thoughts, early second. What do you think?
Well, here's the thing. So this is what it tells me. It tells me that either Carl Lawson or Franklin Myers or one of these guys is gonna be released. They're gonna save cap space, but one of those two, I would say Lawson most likely because he only has 1 year
likely.
Left. You know, but now you drafted the two defensive linemen last year, the two defensive ends in Clemens and Jermaine Johnson. You already have Huff. You know, you're sitting there with Vinny Curry still on the roster. I don't know if he makes it, but he's still on the roster. You have seven bona fide defensive ends. You don't really need seven.
No.
So you figure Lawson's going to be the guy. The one thing you like about McDonald the fourth is that he's 6'4", 239, which means he's broad.
He's got to be fast.
He's very fast, but you can also probably keep him very fast and probably put an extra 10 to 15 pounds on him in his frame without much of a problem. He's not 6'2", he's 6'4". And you can never have enough pass rushers in this league. You got to be able to rush the passer. You got to be able to put pressure on. And
here comes a fresh, fast kid coming in there.
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember, the Jets have to re-sign Quinnen. They have to pay him ransom.
He's a bin, yep.
And Dexter Lawrence got a good contract today from the Giants on his re-sign. He became the third highest paid defensive tackle in history. So you know Quinnen's going to be number one. It was 60 million guaranteed. I think it was 90 million, 60 guaranteed. So you know Quinnen's going to get a huge paycheck. You know you're going to have to cut Lawson to do that. They went out and signed Al Woods this week to be that run-stuffing defensive tackle. They went out and signed Randall Cobb this week, by the way, just because Rodgers wants him.
Rodgers asked for him, yep.
So overall for the Jets, can't say I love the idea of McDonald, but they did steal the show that first night with the kid, Kyle Stickles, going out there and making the selection from the Make-A-Wish. I thought that was one of the coolest moments. And as a Jet fan, I was really kind of proud that he was a Jet fan and he did that.
Yes.
I thought it was probably the coolest moment of the entire draft. In a draft that had nothing really exciting about it. And we talked about it last week. There wasn't a lot of excitement going into it. This kid kind of stole the show. Kev?
Second round. A couple of picks. Yeah. The interesting one. First pick of the second round to the Steelers, Joey Porter Jr.
I knew that was happening right away. I just knew there was no chance he was getting it. They weren't going to sign that. His father was a stud for them. There was no reason not to.
Yeah, you got the picture of Joey Porter Sr. there with a celebrating in the Super Bowl. And there's Junior there in his arms. Now he gets to carry on the legacy. We mentioned the Titans moved up to two to take Levis. Local teams, the Jets and Giants, took the two best center prospects. The Jets at 12 in the second round took Joe Tippmann, best mullet in the draft. And the Giants, true. Giants late in the second round, at number 26 in the second round. I think they were 1A, 1B for prospects.
Yeah, I actually like Schmitz better. But
you like Schmitz a little bit better. But, the Giants, to get Schmitz that late in the round was a great pick for the Giants.
I'm hoping Tippmann is the guy. The thing that the Jets now have is a lot of versatility. They went out and also signed Billy Turner this week that can play tackle as well. They declined Becton's fifth year. I think that was a given.
If you had to. Yeah.
He hasn't played in 2 years. What are you going to do? You sit there and look at it and you're like, all right, you got Brown. You've got Becton. You've got Mitchell coming back and Ogabui, however you pronounce his name, coming back. You brought in Turner. And don't forget that you still have the opportunity to
Vera Tucker.
Vera Tucker. I couldn't think of his name for a second. Elijah Vera Tucker to tackle if needed. So you can play your five best linemen at any point. You know, you can move McGovern to guard. You can move Tippmann to guard. You can do either one.
That's why with McGovern resigning, we're not big fans of McGovern.
He's not a great center. He's okay.
Yeah.
He's just okay.
And if Tippmann shows he's not quite ready, he can live with McGovern. If Tippmann does show he's ready, like you said, it gives you the flexibility. McGovern can slide over to guard, and you can move AVT out wide if you need to. Like I said, they have the flexibility there.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing. Other interesting things in the draft. I thought the Giants did really well early. I thought Shane did a great job. First three rounds, I thought.
Well, the third round pick was Jalen Hyatt.
I thought they did great in the first three rounds. I thought they did.
Hendon Hooker goes to Detroit, fifth pick of the third round. Mm-hmm. Chance for him to sit behind Goff for a year while he heals up fully from the ACL.
I thought Detroit had a strange draft. They went out and got the running back early, but a running back that's not a full-time player. And then Swift demands a trade because of that, and he goes back to Philly, so the rich get richer as he goes to Philly for a fourth and a seventh. I thought that they went a little high with their running back. But, you know, listen, Detroit has actually got a shot to be a favorite or one of the top two choices, I think, right now in that NFC North. So it'll be interesting to see what they do. But losing Swift, I think, hurts them. They already lost Jamal Williams in the offseason. So, you know, they're revamping their running game a little bit with Goff. The Colts with the quarterback, if he's the guy, I mean, you know, that's an interesting thing because it's the fourth pick of the draft. You set your team back a couple of years if he's not the guy.
Yep.
It's a dangerous pick for a guy to complete 53% of his passes against SEC competition to think that he's going to have it all together because he reminds you of Justin Fields and the way he can run and throw, because there's a lot of guys that remind you of Justin Fields and then they can't complete a pass. Yep. And it becomes not a good thing. So that was pretty much my take of it. I thought the Jets did fine. I thought overall the Giants did well. You know, the Texans got the quarterback, our best quarterback to you and I, and the best defensive player in the draft as well. So even though they traded around, I thought they did well. I thought they gave up too much for Will Anderson, but we'll see. If Will Anderson becomes a stud, we'll see. Yep. You know, interesting.
A couple of other interesting quarterback names. Stetson Bennett from Georgia goes to the Rams in the fourth round. Especially if Stafford's healthy, nice chance for him to sit there for a year and learn under McVay and figure out if he can be anything in the NFL. Seventh round, another nice position, maybe to be the backup out there for the Chargers, was Max Duggan from TCU.
Yep.
Some other names, you know, I know Darren and I probably know these names. Maybe other people are listening, maybe not, but Clayton Tune from Houston goes to the Cardinals. I think when you draft a guy like Tune, you can probably keep a similar offense as you run with Murray.
It's the same player, basically.
Yep.
I mean, Kyler higher projected, but definitely
Tune has a chance to be a nice backup out there.
No, I think so. And to be honest with you, you know how I feel about Murray. I don't know if he's the answer there. He got a huge contract, so they're going to give him every opportunity to be the answer.
And Dorian Thompson-Robinson from UCLA, who I think has got some talent, he gets drafted by the Browns in the fifth round.
Yeah, I think DTR is a player. I think he can throw. I think he can run. He's the typical. Again, he's not huge, but he's a good quarterback. He started his entire career at UCLA.
Yep.
You know, he played a ton of football.
Any other draft thoughts?
No, I mean, really, you know, I Stickles was the highlight for me. The only other, just the NFL thought, there's a big rumor. First of all, Aaron Rodgers is everywhere. He's been at Knicks games, he's been at Ranger games.
You like seeing that.
Well, the thing is that that because the Knicks and Rangers are doing well, the Jets are becoming the biggest story in sports right now. Aaron Rodgers is being, you know, when was the last time that happened? I mean, the Jets are actually the biggest story.
Tim Tebow.
Well, that was how we did an interview, but we were more of a laughing stock. Everybody was making fun of us. Now with Aaron Rodgers, people think that we're actually pretty good. But this is a big deal. You know, he was at the game with Sauce Gardner. I mean, he's been making rounds. Who didn't know who Jessica Alba was? I guess she's still
one. That was a great line.
You know, you got this kid out there at the games with Aaron Rodgers who's showing face all over the place. It's nice to see that. And the rumor is Monday night, the kickoff of the season, 7 o'clock, and the doubleheader is the Giants versus the Jets.
Wow. It
would be an interesting Monday night kickoff game for the Giants and the Jets. Be a very hot ticket here in New York on anniversary of 9/11.
Who's the home team that night?
I think it's the Jets.
Is it Jets?
I think it's the Jets. I'm not 100%.
Oh, great. So it'll be a Giant home game.
Be a Jet home game on 9/11, anniversary of 9/11. Be very interested to see the two New York teams play each other in New Jersey.
Yes, of course, in New Jersey.
But that's it. Any other NFL thoughts for you?
Nope, that's it for me.
All right, let's get to the Derby because we're going long here. 20 horses, all right? The 149th Kentucky Derby. Going to run through them real quick just to give you a little bit of a highlight. The one-horse hit show, Manny Franco on board. Brad Cox is the trainer. This is a stalking horse, 3-1 over three wins, 1 second place in 5 starts, including 2nd in the wood. The second horse, Verifying, another Brad Cox horse with Tyler Gaffilione. He runs up front. He's got 2 wins in 2 places in 6 starts, lost by a neck in the bluegrass. All right, third is 2 Phils. Larry Ravelli training, Jareth Loveberry on board, 12-1 morning line. Won the Jeff Ruby Stakes, the one we never heard of. In 8 starts, he's 1-4, 1 second, and 1 third. He's a closer, okay? Fourth horse is Confidence Game. This is a $25,000 claimer horse that's running in the Derby, so it's impressive. Keith DeSormo trains it. James Graham runs on it, 20-1 morning line. Got 3 wins in 7 starts with a 2nd and 2/3. He won the Rebel, okay? Tap It Trice, second choice in the field. Todd Pletcher trains him. Luis Saiz aboard, 5-1 morning line. He's got 5 starts. He's got 4 wins and a 3rd. Won the Bluegrass, all right? And a great race, he actually gets Verifying. Won by a head, a desperate neck, as they once said, Kev. 5-1. King's Barns, Todd Pletcher again with Jose Ortiz aboard. 12-1 morning line. He's got 3 starts. He's won them all, okay? Did not race as a 2-year-old. Won the Louisiana Derby. The 7th horse is the Reincarnate, Tim Yachtin. Yachtin has a lot of horses because Baffert can't train any of them, and they all went from one barn to the other. Yachtin, he's got John Velasquez aboard. 50-1 horse. Reincarnate in 7 starts has 2 wins, 3 seconds, and 2 thirds. By the way, Kings Barnes runs up to the pace, and Reincarnate is near the front. Tap It Trice is a closer. The 8 horses made.
Let me just ask you real quick. So you've got a lot of early speed. You already mentioned Verifying, Confidence Game, Kings Barnes, and Reincarnate. Very key. I think that they all drew inside post too if they've got the speed.
Oh, absolutely.
Got to get out there, get out in front, and get to the rail as much as you can. So they got advantageous post positions there.
Yeah, only the 12 and the 17 are also outside. They have outside post horses that like to run near the front, and we'll get to them in a second. Mage is the 8 horse. Castellano aboard with Gustavo Delgado, 15-1. He's 1-1, 1 win, 1 second, and 3 starts. Did not run as a 2-year-old also. Had the lead in the last race and lost it to Forte. The 9 is Skinner. 6 starts, 1 win, 3 thirds. Switch jockeys for this race. So he goes, Sheriffs is the trainer. They go to Juan Hernandez instead of Victor Espinosa. Not normally a move you would see. They just wanted to try something different. This horse is a dead closer. Okay, number 10 horse is Practical Move. 7 starts, 4 wins, 2/3, won the Santa Anita Derby. Practical Move has Tim Yachtin as the trainer and Ramon Vasquez aboard, 10-1 shot. 11 is Disarm, okay? 5 starts, 1 win, 2 seconds, 2/3. Only win was a maiden special weight in Saratoga at 6.5 furlongs, just so you know. Disarm has Steve Asmussen, who's never won this race, despite all the wins he's had over his lifetime. And Joel Rosario is the jockey, 30-1 morning line. The 12 horses, Jace's Road, Brad Cox trainer. Florent Giroux is the jockey, 50-1. This is a horse that likes to run near the lead, okay? 2 wins, 2/3, and 6 starts. The 13, another deep closer, Sun Thunder. Brian Hernandez, the jockey. Kenny McPeak is the trainer, 50-1 also morning line. This is, 1-1-1, 1 win, 1 second, 1 third, and 6 starts. Number 14, Angel of Empire. Flavian Pratt rides it. Brad Cox trains him. 8-1 morning line. This horse is a mid-pack horse, basically. It's nice to run for the mid-pack. $70,000 claimer horse, so nothing special. 4 wins and a 2nd and 6 starts. He's a Pennsylvania bred. Only 2 of them have ever won this race. Last one being Smarty Jones. And he won the Arkansas Derby last time out. Number 15, Forte, the favorite. Todd Pletcher trains him. Erod Ortiz Jr. rides him. 3-1 morning line. That'll probably go down a little bit, even though there's a good horse in this field. He's a mid-pack closer, if you you want to just kind of take his the way he runs. 6-0-0 in his seven starts, including five wins in a row. He had one fourth place finish at Saratoga in a Grade 3 race last year. But he's looking to become the third Breeders' Cup Juvenile winner to win this race. 16, Raising Cane. You have Geraldo Corrales and Ben Colebrook is the trainer, 50-1. This is a horse that's a closer. Two wins in seven starts. Two wins, one second, one third. He finished fifth in the Bluegrass. Number 17, but this year you got points for finishing fifth. A little different than it had been in the past. 17, Derma Sodagaki. First horse I haven't seen yet. The jockey is Christophe Lemaire. The trainer is Hidetaka Otanashi. It's 10-1 morning lines. This is the horse that won the Arab Emirates race. You know, overall, never seen him run. Four wins in eight starts with two thirds. The 18 is Rocket Can. The great Bill Mott training. Junior Alvarado aboard, 30-1. Rocket, he's a stalker. Two wins in seven starts. Finished fourth in the Arkansas Derby. 19, Lord Miles. Jockey's Paco Lopez. Yes, Kev.
Lord Miles is scratched.
Oh, he was scratched. Okay.
Light scratch, yep.
All right, Joseph Safi was the trainer on that one. Does not matter. 59-1 shot. He wasn't expected to make this race anyway. And the 20 is Continuar. Sakai is the jockey. I'm not even going to try the first name. And Yoshino Yahagi is the trainer. This horse has two wins and five career starts. He finished third at the UAE. He's also a stalker. Lord Miles actually had an interesting thing because their owner was Pete Vesco. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's the author of Chicken Soup for the Soul.
Oh, wow.
Just a little thought process there. So these are the 20 horses. Again, like you said, a lot of the horses that needed to get out front, except for, and even the 12 isn't a real bad spot for a horse that wants to get out front, but a lot of them running from the inside. So Kev, if I had to pin it to you, who do you like to win this race?
I've always been a favorite guy. You know that.
Well, yeah, you can analyze for 20 minutes and come up with the first choice and the second choice.
Maybe, yep, hey,
maybe bet him in inverted order every now and again.
Yep. I'm also rooting for Forte. I mentioned it, I think, last week. Mm-hmm. The owner was Mike Rapoli.
Yep.
Who was a 1986 graduate of Holy Cross High School. Go Knights. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so yeah, like I said, I didn't know Mike in school, so it's not like I have this close personal connection, but you know, it's just, you know, cool to have a Holy Cross, a fellow knight there, doing well enough to own horses. Like I said, Pletcher Ortiz, he's a closer with in a race with speed, so as a closer coming from the 15, you don't mind that too much. You know, maybe avoid the early traffic, get settled in there, and find a path on the outside to close. The other, you know, he's a second choice, but you gotta really like Tappet Trice also. The other Pletcher horse with Saez up, another closer. But I was also looking at some of the longer shots. You know, you mentioned Kane's Barnes. Lady Safe Sora was 11-1. His sire was Uncle Mo, whose son Nyquist won in 2016.
Absolutely.
You want to go a little bit further odds?
That was the last Breeders' Juvenile winner to win, by the way. It was Nyquist, by the way.
Rocket Can, 50-1.
He's been competitive in every race, by the way.
That daddy was Into Mischief.
Yep.
He's had two Kentucky Derby winners, Mandaloon and Authentic. Does Rocket Can pull off the upset and make it three Kentucky Derby winners for Into Mischief? If the track is a little off tomorrow, I know there's some rain in the forecast early. It sounds like it's not going to be raining by the time the Derby runs. I should say on Saturday, not tomorrow. Confidence Game, like you said, did win the Rebel Stakes. It was on and off track, so he's got experience running there. He also has a win over Churchill Downs. So if I were to pick, I'm going to go Forte winning it. Since I talk about him, I'm going to go Rocket Can as the upset in second, and then Tappet Trice in third.
All right.
That's my three.
Well, I also like Forte, but I've been on Forte since December. I really can't back off him now. I just thought he was the best horse all year. Last race wasn't his best, and he just found a way to come up and pull it out at the end, beating Mage. I have King's Barnes finishing second. I like the early speed. I think that Ortiz will kind of control it. And I think Practical Move is a little bit under bet right here, and I have him finishing third, the Santa Anita winner.
I'm just reading here, too. Practical Move was scratched. Elevated Temperature.
Oh, when did that happen?
Sometime this afternoon.
I missed it. Okay.
I'm just reading this now.
Shoot.
I would have caught it earlier if I'd seen it.
No, that's fine. Well, you know what? I'm gonna put Verifying in there as my third choice, who's a bit of a long shot.
Yep.
Couple of other horses that I think could make a run. I think Skinner can make a run. I think he's such a dead closer that if the speed comes up, is he out too?
No, he's in there, but his daddy was curling.
I know. I was about to say that. His father could close, yep. You know, and he could close too. I mean, curling kind of played mid-pack more. Tapper Trice is hard a hard horse not to like.
Yeah.
And if I was going to take one horse from the outside, you know, I go back and forth between Rocket Can and Dermis Ogataki. I haven't seen Dermis, so I'm not going to do it. So I'm going to put Rocket Can as a horse to throw into your exotics as well.
Wow.
But I know. I watched him race like four times. I kind of like the horse. He just has never had that. It was either him or Reincarnate. I was between the two, to be honest with you. I've seen them both race several times. And I like Rocket Can a little bit more. So if you're going to go with me, it's going to be Forte, Kingsborn second, and I'm going to put Verifying third, with a shot for Skinner, and Rocket Can, and I like Hit Show a little bit more, but I hate the one spot, so I can't bet it.
Yeah, just for anybody who's still listening, an hour and 20 minutes in, Darren and I don't talk before the podcast. Anything like this. So the fact that we came up with the same types of picks and the same long shots in here,
it's just kind of a miracle. Well, we've bet horses together a long time, so it's not really weird that we see the same things when we bet. If you listen to the podcast, you've heard me. I've been on Forte since the very beginning. I didn't realize Practical Move got scratched. I thought that was a horse that had some at 10-1 would give me good odds for a really good horse. You know, and I like King's Barnes. I mean, he hasn't lost yet. I don't think he's going to win this race, but I think he could finish in that in second. And really, if he can control, there's going to be speed in this race, but I believe six is going to be the horse that gets out and controls it. That's what I believe anyway. We'll see. We'll see if that actually happens. Verifying could also be there just to annoying. I could have my two horses burn each other out and finish 15th and 16th respectively. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, so that's our Kentucky Derby breakdown. Maybe a little long, but we wanted you to know everything there was to know about the horse so that you could sit there and at least have a little bit of something to do besides just pick the favorite name when you're looking at the sheet on Saturday. So, Kev, anything else in sports you'd like to touch on before we move on?
I think we've talked enough.
Yeah, we thought we'd be under an hour. We're an hour and 22. Gino's going to make fun of us. So because there was no one here to keep us in line. So without, you know, so basically, you know, we are the Sports Kings from Queens. I'm Darren here with Kevin, our friend Gino, not with us tonight, but always here with us on the show. You know, you can find our podcast anywhere. You can download your podcast, whether it be an Apple product, whether it be Spotify, whether it be TuneIn, whether you just go and ask Alexa to play it. So we're all over the place. We post a lot of stuff on Facebook and social media. Please follow us, like us, share us. Let people know what's going on. Let people know. Let us know, I should say, what you want to hear more of. And we just want to give you guys what you want. We love talking sports, and we want to talk about you guys. So without any further ado, may your sports and may the fourth be with you.
Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.